Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly tow truck job out of the desert mud of American politics. I am Matt Welch, joined by Catherine Mangu Ward, returning guest star CJ Sharamala. Close. And in his maiden, isn't it? I thought it was close. And in his maiden Reason Roundtable voyage, subbing in for a Burning Man marooned Nick Gillespie, Reason's very own assistant editor, Joe Lancaster. Welcome, team.
Howdy.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
CJ, give me the pronunciation guide again to your last name.
Well, it got anglicized, so it's like everyone says Sharamala.
Sharamala?
Sharamala, yeah.
I won't do that.
If you said it in like the Italian, I think it's like Sharamala.
You but should do that, Matt. That seems like what you should go with.
I'm going to triangulate, but err on the side of the Italians. Okay. At any rate, we're going to get to some of the long prison sentences handed down last week and perhaps even today to participants of the January 6th, 2021 riot on Capitol Hill. But first, a word from our sponsor, Donors Trust, the principled and tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving. Friends, left-wing mega donors are shoveling money into pet projects that don't reflect American values. What's more, lawmakers continue to push bloated big government policies like so-called student loan cancellation and other programs that will inevitably raise prices and fail to reach the people they are allegedly meant to help. All is not lost, though. You can help turn the tide with a charitable giving account at Donors Trust. Donors Trust is a refuge from the storm of harmful progressive philanthropy and big government wheeling and dealing, helping you to maximize your giving while minimizing your tax liability. Whether it's defending speech, empowering entrepreneurs to offer educational alternatives, or fighting green energy extremists, Donors Trust is the charitable giving account provider for you. Visit www.donorstrust.org/reason to learn more about how Donors Trust can minimize your tax liability and maximize your giving. Once more, that's www.donorstrust.org/reason. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, former Proud Boys National Chairman Enrique Tarrio is scheduled to receive a prison sentence today for his conviction back in May of seditious conspiracy over his role in the January 6th riot on Capitol Hill during Congress's ratification of the 2020 presidential election results. Three other Proud Boys leaders were also convicted of seditious conspiracy in that case, received sentences last week of between 15 and 18 years in prison. Tarrio, it should be noted, did not participate in the riot, nor did he attend the rally that preceded it. He had been arrested in Washington 2 days before for tearing down a Black Lives Matter banner, hard to say, and possessing high-capacity firearms magazines. Prosecutors, however, successfully argued that he was a ringleader of a conspiracy to, in the words of Attorney General Merrick Garland, oppose by force the lawful transfer of presidential power. CJ, since you cover criminal justice, I want to start with you, specifically regarding the 17-year prison sentence handed down late last week to Proud Boy leader Joe Biggs. Our colleague Robbie Suave wrote that the prosecutor in that case sought and kind of maybe partially received a terrorism enhancement in that sentencing, even though January 6th, I do not think, is accurately described as an act of terrorism. Can you walk us through the abnormalities or the not business as usualness of what appears to my layman's eyes as a pretty damn long prison sentence?
Yeah. So federal prosecutors have really wanted to make an example out of the January 6th defendants, especially the ones they see as organizers or instigators. A lot of the January 6th defendants received relatively minor charges of like trespassing or obstructing and got like a year or two on probation or, you know, relatively smaller sentences. But for the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and some of the other actors, the Justice Department really decided that he wanted to bring the hammer down on these guys. And what they used were these sort of vague, really scary sounding laws like seditious conspiracy or these terrorism enhancements to sort of throw the book at these guys. And in the case of Biggs, the prosecutor actually argued that the psychological fallout from January 6th is, quote, no different than the act of a spectacular bombing of a building, unquote.
Nope.
Just like bombing a building.
No, I can see some differences, like some critical ones.
There's some fairly large differences, mainly being that the building is still standing. But yeah, they have been using these terrorism and the seditious conspiracy laws to hammer these guys. And it's sort of what we see, you know, conservatives and right-wing media have been focusing a lot on this, how outrageous it is. And it is. I'm not disputing this is outrageous, but this is what the federal government does when defendants plead not guilty, when they fight the government, when they have disfavored political views. Federal prosecutors will use everything in their considerable arsenal to hammer these guys and get the longest sentence possible. And what they did is sort of the classic negotiating tactic where they asked for a 33-year sentence, I believe, in Biggs' case. And the judge was like, well, that's outrageous. I'm not giving you that. Oh, well, how about a compromise and say 17 years? So, you know, they got a very long sentence by asking for something completely absurd. And, you know, prosecutors have a relatively easy job in the criminal justice system compared to defense attorneys. Juries are willing and want to trust prosecutors in a lot of cases, especially when you have disfavored defendants or unsympathetic defendants. And so they are able to use these terrorism enhancements, these seditious conspiracy charges to really ring these guys up. The terrorism enhancement was actually a funny little note is from the, now I'm going to forget the acronym, the AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Messing up the acronym, but passed in the mid 90s to sort of speed up death penalty cases or death penalty post-conviction and also enhance prosecution for terrorism charges. The real effect of it has been short-circuiting habeas appeals by federal inmates. It's had a horrible effect on the ability of federal inmates to appeal their convictions after they've been sentenced. And conservatives have actually loved it for that reason. It really jammed up federal inmates and their ability to file habeas appeals. But now, as we can see, it's also being used to ring up a Proud Boy on a terrorism enhancement in what is pretty obviously a stretch of the intent of that act.
That's a classic law and politics thereof. You'll recall that the president, I believe, in the mid-1990s was a Democrat. If I'm not mistaken, Bill Clinton. And that law also made it possible for border agents to stamp "you can't enter" on any like normal tourist having or tourist waiver or visa waiver having tourist in the United States, which the New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis wrote about a lot. And we wrote a lot about at Reason as well. Catherine, let's talk about seditious conspiracy. That sounds like two words that libertarians hate, like mashed up together to make something even more hateable. Should that be a thing? And should that thing be used in these cases?
It is hard for me to imagine the use of this thing in the context of all the other things we already have to throw at people who are doing stuff we don't like. So sedition in general, not a word that has like a great pedigree in U.S. law. The Alien and Sedition Acts, right from the get-go, not our finest hour. And, you know, just in general, the notion of, you know, sedition being opposition to the state in a kind of active way. I don't know if I'm trying to think of like a colloquial way to describe that word. And I think like I'm in favor of that a bunch of times. I love me some sedition in the spiritual sense. Similarly with conspiracy, you know, the conspiracy charges, we've written a lot and talked a lot about RICO charges. But there are lots of other cases where when prosecutors don't quite have all of their ducks in a row, they can just throw a kind of conspiracy charge on there and maybe scoop up someone who otherwise would have gotten away. Now, as CJ was talking, I was just reminded that the incentives for prosecutors are so bad, right? Like winning is getting more years. And when you pair that with the negotiation situation that CJ described, where you just make a really, really outrageous first offer and then negotiate down from there, we're just measuring the wrong thing. like, it's, you know, the idea that we are somehow like, well, we got these guys because a couple of them got really, really long sentences. We didn't. That did not achieve, you know, achieve the goal of discouraging other folks from doing this down the line, I don't think. And in the meantime, it creates the sense that there is unevenly applied justice or maybe even injustice.
Joe, you've been a critic recently of Fannie Willis stretching the interpretation of the aforementioned RICO laws down in the Georgia case against Donald Trump. Do you see any similar type of interpretive overstretch in the Proud Boys convictions and sentences specifically, or in the January 6th prosecutions generally?
I do. The Proud Boys sentencings seem a bit of a piece with the, you know, the conversation we've been having over the past 20 plus years, which is, what do we actually mean when we talk about terrorism? Because more and more, it just seems like as we talk about it and litigate it and prosecute it, it has expanded to the point where now it's just vibes, basically.
feels terroristy.
Yeah, yeah. And the RICO statutes are a similar thing. You know, District Attorney in Georgia, Fannie Willis, used that state's RICO statute against Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants over their actions in that state when he tried to keep being president after the American people told him otherwise. And RICO statutes in general are a bit of an icky area, but the Georgia statute in particular is a bit broader and it's a bit easier to bring charges. And just like with terrorism, it's the use of a statute to apply to behavior that is pretty objectionable overall, but to tar it with the name in that case of racketeering, you know, activity akin to the mob, or in this case, sedition or terrorism. You know, the couple years ago, the Michigan school shooter. This is kind of piggybacking off of something that CJ said. Michigan school shooter was charged not just with, you know, murder and attempted murder, but also terrorism, because the prosecutor said that, well, you have to think about the effect on the community. The community was afraid, is terrorized now. That doesn't feel like what, and again, I'm falling victim to this now too. I'm using the word feel. I'm using the vibes.
Do people
framework.
Still say like big X energy? Like, can we say something has big terrorism energy, or did like the kids stop saying that?
They stopped it, but that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, let them seize the kids.
Means of cultural production before we completely allow them to run everything.
Sure.
CJ, I feel a lot of whataboutism in my heart, and I certainly see a lot of it out there when it comes to these prosecutions. Like, what about the Portland protesters that laid siege to a federal building for 100 days or something like that? What about the lawyer scumbags in New York who threw Molotov cocktails into a cop car and got 1 year? What about John Walker Lind, who was sentenced, and granted this is a plea, but agreement, but he got 20 years. These guys are going to get 17, 18 years. Is there an apples to apples comparison here that makes this stuff look weird?
You know, like I said, it's very obvious that the Justice Department wants to go down hard on these guys, wants to come down hard on them, because, yeah, I'll say about the guys torching the cop car, there is a difference in that case. The two people who torched the NYPD cop car both pleaded guilty.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very big difference when you're talking about the outcomes of trials. You know, in cases where J6 defendants did plead guilty, the judge and express remorse, you know, the judges were much more likely to go easy on them. And when you do that in general, you have a much better outcome than when you plead not guilty and leave yourself to the mercy of a jury and a judge and federal prosecutors to decide just how long you should go to prison.
Isn't that kind of bad?
It is. The plea bargaining system is extremely bad in America. And that's one of the big issues we saw in J6. Conservatives were suddenly like, this is outrageous. These people are getting hammered for not pleading guilty or for pleading not guilty. I'm like, yes, that is a huge facet of our criminal justice system, is that our plea bargaining system is broken and results in a huge penalty if you exercise your constitutional right to go to a trial. The other interesting thing about this case, which, you know, if we're talking about both sides and whataboutism, is I saw after the sentences were handed down, these very long sentences, the reactions from liberals on Twitter were like, oh, not long enough. They're going there. That's a slap on the wrist. 10 years, get out of here. And, you know, the way we talk about sentences in sentencing in America is so distorted and bizarre compared to the rest of the world, where you're looking at 10 years in federal prison and you're saying like, that's nothing. That's a walk in the park. These guys deserve 50 years. They deserve life. I mean, you know, 17 years in prison is a really, really long time. We're not talking about light sentences here. These are life-changing sentences that will affect the course of these guys' lives and their families' lives for, you know, decades.
Joe, is there some be careful what you wish for lessons here for Democrats, sort of piggybacking on what CJ was just talking about, or even anti-Trumpers overall when it comes to maximizing prosecutorial effort in cases that involve politics getting a little violent around the edges?
Absolutely. In Georgia, where district attorney just, you know, charged Donald Trump and his co-conspirators with RICO charges, there is an ongoing protest movement against a police training facility being built in that same county. And over the past year or so, there have been instances where the state prosecutors have started becoming more aggressive in their prosecutions of those protesters, most of whom have just been accused of misdemeanor trespassing. Some have, you know, burned equipment, burned cop cars, committed acts of vandalism, acts of violence, but they've been applied or they've been charged in a lot of cases with domestic terrorism. And just this morning, just a couple hours ago, local media was reporting that over 60 people have now been charged with RICO charges over their actions in opposing a public development. Now, again, like I said, I'm not going to go so far as to defend every single person's every action. Like I said, there have been acts of violence. There have been plenty of other things. But in the overwhelming majority of these cases, it is just the example of prosecutors saying that these people are doing something bad. They constitute a bad group. And so, therefore, they're applying the maximum possible charge to them.
I also think, like, just anytime you create a category that's like, okay, yes, we want to be proportional and we're like, we care about justice and like, we want to follow precedent, but we have this new category and it's something really, really bad, like child sex trafficking or terrorism. And we're making this category and it's like the bets are off for this category because it's so bad. And then 100% of the time, normal shit will be shoehorned into that category. That's just what happens.
And drug war stuff.
And like, especially drug war stuff. Especially people just trying to put a substance in their body for funsies. That one will always end up being both terrorism and child sex trafficking somehow. But I think it's like if you make a category that's outside the rules, people enjoy being outside the rules. And so they will try to get themselves into this category, prosecutors and others. And it's not good.
This is also true for financial privacy and lack thereof. The first Supreme Court case having to do with the constitutionality of this, and I think this is the, you know, snoop on your bank account if there's any transaction $10,000 or more. It could be a different one, but it's basically the same category. That was enacted in the late 60s, early 70s as a fight against the mob, right? And so there was a Fourth Amendment challenge, search and seizure. Like, wait a second, these people, they didn't do a crime, and they just did a transaction, and now you have the like blanket right to investigate all of this. And they're in the Supreme Court decision ratifying this. There was language like, well, normally this looks like a really horrible Fourth Amendment violation, but the mob, man, they are really bad. And then as soon as that was ratified, then all the drugs, none of the mob, all of the drugs almost immediately. Catherine, to put a cap on this, as the kids say, do you see an endless future, being a nihilist, an endless future of tit for tat political prosecutions? And if so, how do we avoid it?
I do see an endless future of political prosecutions that are vengeful in nature. The only way I could see out of it would be like a radical de-escalation across the board. Like, because this is the issue, is if these tools are available, they will be used in a politicized way by actors who are doing prosecutions at the highest level. So the only way to protect our beloved politicians from forever jail is to protect everyone from forever jail, I am sorry to say.
All right. Have you all heard out there in listenerdom the one about Robin Ware or Robert L. Peters or J.R.B. Ware? J.R.B. sounds an awful lot like Joseph Robinette Biden the second. Indeed, those three names are aliases that the current president of the United States of America used in emails sent and received when he was vice president of the United States of America. And now a Freedom of Information Act suit has unearthed the presence of 5,400 such communications, including, of course, some back and forth on government sounding business with none other than Biden's corrupt, crackheaded son, Hunter. CJ, you wrote about this. What do we know about the emails, whether they indicate corruption, whether we will get to read them all, and whether their existence violates disclosure rules and even laws?
Okay, so we got to get into some weeds here, because the provenance of these emails is how this originally came out was out of Hunter Biden's infamous laptop, libertarian hero Hunter Biden. Anyways, a few emails came out of that laptop that appeared to be between Hunter and his proud Papa Joe, where he's using these aliases, and they were discussing stuff like potential appointments to the Treasury Department in one case and things like that. And so the New York Post reported that Biden was using at least three of these pseudonyms on emails that mixed family and government business. And this is part of the Republican investigation to the Biden family's business activities and potential influence peddling by Hunter and an alleged involvement of Biden. You probably heard Republicans talking about the Biden crime family, et cetera. So this is all wrapped up in that, which I'll be honest, I haven't followed a lot of the ins and outs of, because it's a lot of Bleamer and Glortman kind of talk. But what interested me was these aliases, because under the Freedom of Information Act and the National Archives, who are supposed to be collecting all of these emails, you know, you're supposed to have a government email address, and all your official business is supposed to go to those, so that everything is properly archived and everyone knows where it's at. But in practice, senior administration officials over at least the past few administrations have been using alias email addresses, and in some cases, even private email addresses like Gmail, to do official business. And there have been concerns from transparency groups and watchdog groups that these are skirting the Freedom of Information Act and federal records law. You might remember there was a minor scandal involving Hillary Clinton and a private email server back in 2015 or 2016. So anyways, a nonprofit group filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit trying to get emails from these aliases for the National Archives. And the archives responded saying they had found 5,400 potential responsive records. Now, no one's seen these responsive records yet. I want to be clear about that. We don't know what's in the emails. We don't know if they're chock-a-block full of Joe Biden being like, give my son Hunter all the money from China so he can put it up his nose. So we don't know what's in them. But it is potentially problematic that Biden has these aliases. We're supposed to be complying with these record laws, and we're supposed to be keeping track of what you're doing. So we want to, I think NARA should release these. House Republicans are calling for these emails to be released immediately so we can just see what's in them. NARA probably should, honestly, to get out ahead of this, and Biden would probably like to as well. but it is a bad problem. It is a transparency problem, and it is widespread throughout the federal government. Scott Pruitt, the former EPA administrator, had 4 aliases, which I think is the most I'm aware of. The EPA administrator, a couple of them had 8 aliases. And they all do this just to sort of, they say the reason is to sort of have a manageable inbox that's not their public one, which gets flooded with spam and cranks and all that. So they say it's for convenience sake. But it creates doubts with the requesters and archivists, because how are you supposed to know if you are getting the emails you're asking for if there are all these unknown aliases floating around? How do we know that you're doing all your business on the up and up? And that is a major concern for Biden and his family right now, is they're Republicans and a lot of other people don't trust his judgment with his business and his relationship with his son. And if these aliases and private email addresses turned out to be used for government business, it is going to be a major transparency and ethics problem for Biden.
Joe, on that topic, Republicans and others have accused the media in particular of having a striking amount of incuriosity when it comes to the Joe Biden side of the Hunter Biden skeeziness story. Do they have a point?
I think they do to an extent. Especially during the election, there was, of course, a very almost knee-jerk reaction to dismiss the laptop story in the first place as either a fake story or Russian disinformation. So there's certainly an aspect to that. At the same time, I do have a bit of hesitation to go too far into the weeds on it, just because I feel like I have been promised something from this story for a long time. There has yet to be anything definitive. Obviously, that could be contained in these emails, but I don't know. I have trouble really extolling one way or the other how these emails actually are. But I do think to an extent they absolutely do have a point, that there is a tendency to believe the official line in this case that wasn't always afforded in the prior administration, justifiably, I think. So, you know, I'm certainly open to whatever these emails may reveal personally.
Catherine, again, lead us out of this if you can. You know, if this goes back to Hillary Clinton, little problem there. Scott Pruitt's doing this. Seems like it's being done a lot. What is a way to prevent this from being an indefinite future of opposition House Committee on Government Malfeasance, you know?
The Permanent Select Committee on Email Aliases. Yeah.
What do we do?
This is, you know, something in CJ's reporting about this actually caught my eye, which was, he just mentioned, you know, Obama saying, hey, it's so hard because, like, I have this public email address, but sometimes I just want to be able to, like, email people from an email. Like, you don't need a secret email for that. Like, there are easy technological solutions to having, like, some nested aliases, to having official government accounts that are not public. Like, this is a solvable problem. And to pretend like, oh, the only way to solve this problem is to have a Hillary Clinton-style private email server where I mix my yoga class plans with, like, official state business is totally disingenuous. I have mixed feelings about, you know, how many of your rights and privileges you waive when you go to work for the government. But one thing that I feel great about is I am willing to apply for government officials only the if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear standard. Like, you don't get privacy in your emails because you should not be doing shady shit on the job. You are the president of the United States. We don't want our public officials to be blackmailable and suspect to other world leaders and to their own citizenry. And the way that you avoid that is just by doing your work on the up and up in official channels. And if that is too much for you, don't be president. Like, if you need a secret email to communicate with your crackheaded son, consider not being president. Like, I just think that that's a reasonable thing to ask of our presidents.
We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, how many times a year do you get that letter from your health insurance company? You know, the one that has like four pages of gobbledygook, but somewhere on the first page, it's all, we reviewed your totally normal recurring claim and decided randomly that you didn't need this one, which we are informing you with language so bureaucratic you might not even notice. Then you have to call, sit on hold for a long time. Someone in a call center finally answers, says something about having the wrong code. You don't know what that means. And basically you spend 5 hours maybe fixing a $100+ overcharge. And you do this several times a year, or worse yet, you don't, and you just lose money. Surely there's a better system. CrowdHealth is that system. You just pay $50 a month, get access to telemedicine and discounted drug prices. None of this in-network mumbo-jumbo or coverage gaps or COBRA. Get your own personal care advocate and enjoy peace of mind about unexpected medical emergencies for $50 a month. It's time you opt out of restrictive and opaque health insurance plans and let CrowdHealth help fit your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $50 per month. Use the code ROUNDTABLE to get the healthcare you deserve. Please note, the CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com, code ROUNDTABLE. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Henry in the UK, who writes, recent years have seen the rebirth of a reactionary kind of feminism that seemed for a while to have almost gone extinct. Its advocates include veteran activists like Julie Bindle and rising stars like Louise Perry. Their concerns range from the common sense, kids shouldn't be able to access pornography, to the highly questionable, porn is an addictive drug that turns men into violent monsters. Writers such as Barry Weiss and Wesley Yang, who are otherwise pretty good on freedom of speech and other civil liberties, seem oddly charmed by all this. Freedom, they seem to say, is bad for you. What do you make of this trend towards sexual reaction? Why does it seem to be gaining ground against more libertarian approaches to feminism, such as the work of Reason's own Elizabeth Nolan Brown? Catherine, you're a lady person. What say you? Is the premise correct of this email? And if so, what?
I don't know why we got to drag feminism into this. This doesn't seem like it's feminism's fault. A lot of things are feminism's fault, arguably. But this is a real bipartisan, bi-gender, feminist, anti-feminist team project. David French, I suppose, might describe himself as a feminist, but his arguments against this in the recent New York Times op-ed are certainly not feminist arguments per se. I think this is like a huge, for sure, notable reactionary trend in which the notion that pornography is ruining society. I mean, lots of things are always ruining society in op-eds, right? I think today we learned that Taylor Swift is ruining society again from the otherwise excellent Mark Hemingway in The Federalist. But there is an anti-freedom bias in this reactionary movement. I don't think feminism has anything to do with it. There just happen to be some ladies hanging around, but not everything that ladies do is feminism.
Ooh. I don't know if I can even understand that. Being a non-lady, CJ, talk a little bit about the David French op-ed, which was endorsed wholeheartedly by Jonathan Haidt. So there's a lot of people there who have a history of being on the pretty strong free speech side of free speech, at least David French. I don't know about John Haidt these days with his anti-tech stuff that's going on. But there's a lot of momentum right now about finding pretty hard solutions to the online porn problem. Vivek Ramaswamy, who I believe is the second or third ranked Republican presidential candidate, wants to ban social media for 16-year-olds, which seems totally workable. Can you talk a little bit about this phenomenon and what you see as the sort of deficiencies in their argumentation?
Yeah, it has a lot of big violent video games energy to me. The debate very much sort of reminds me of the violent video game debates, and is sort of the same general sort of big swing there is that, you know, I think there's a grain of truth in this argument, which is that like porn exposure is not good for teenagers, and for a small percentage of people, it can have like very bad sort of desensitizing or weird effects on them. But, you know, you're talking about something like with violent video games, millions of people play violent video games, only a handful, you know, take it into real life or have weird delusions about it. But I think it is what we're seeing these arguments is, specifically David French, is looking at why the problems we're currently having with states trying to enforce age verification on online porn sites. This is the big new push, especially among the sort of reactionary or conservative right, is they believe they finally found the legal mechanism to stop children from accessing porn and also make it extremely annoying for adults to do so, which is to make states are trying to pass laws enforcing porn sites to require age verification. The problem they're running into is Supreme Court precedent. And David French, I think, argues somewhat convincingly that the Supreme Court precedent here is kind of outdated. They're relying on Reno versus ACLU, which, you know, said that there were technological restrictions to try and do these sort of age-based restrictions on online content, online publishers. And French is basically arguing that, like, no, we've moved past this now. There are the technology has advanced to the point where we can obviously do this. And the Supreme Court will probably be looking at this again. I think in Texas, a age verification law was just temporarily, there was a temporary injunction against an age verification law, citing Reno versus ACLU. And that will probably maybe tee up a case for a Supreme Court to look at. So basically what you have is this big trend of age verification laws, and we are quickly approaching a possible Supreme Court reconsideration of this precedent that does make it hard to enforce these sort of age laws. I think the deficiency is it's just a really big government solution to something that I think parents can reasonably do themselves. It is a lot harder. I don't have a teenage daughter or son, so I don't have a lot of experience in this yet. I know it's a lot harder with today's cell phones and internet to keep kids from seeing really, really weird stuff. But, you know, maybe the solution I think is we should actually revert the technology back to like 1998, where it is, where if you look at porn, it destroys your computer and fills it with malware. We should just make all websites 1998 so that everyone knows if you looked at porn because you start getting like 20 pop-ups on your screen.
Make the internet 1998 again. Yeah. Like, let's embroider that on a hat.
Yeah, let's test that theory since Joe is a youth, despite the fact that he's wearing a Metallica shirt. Joe, do you know what hamster dance is?
I do, but thank you for calling me a youth despite that.
You have to sing the little song now, though, to prove that you know.
This podcast is over.
It is obviously Catherine.
I'm not gonna sing the little song. Yeah, there it is.
All right. Sorry about that, everyone, especially to Fred Young. No, Joe. Thoughts on feminism, the porns, the youths? Is your entire generation destroyed?
Yeah, but that was baked in already. That long predated this topic. I like David French as a writer and as an individual. This op-ed of his kind of bummed me out. He used the example of New York in the 70s of the proliferation of, you know, sex shops and adult theaters in Times Square, and how New York really cleaned up its act and seems to be making the case that we should be able to do that too. First of all, I think it's arguable whether the way that New York went about doing that was, you know, the paragon of effectiveness, but it's two entirely separate things to, for example, put an age verification on a store or a theater versus putting age verification on a website. And he has the quote in there that, you know, there are age limits for users on Instagram, Facebook, Reddit, Twitter. Yes, creative kids can circumvent age restrictions, just as enterprising teens can create fake IDs in the real world. It is orders of magnitude easier to click over 18 than it is to get a passable fake ID. And, you know, bars in every city in this country are able to enforce ID regulations for things like that in a way that websites can't without just creating a huge privacy violation or potential privacy violation in that they would have to keep and store all sorts of user data that would make it susceptible to being hacked. Australia is pretty, honestly, kind of bad on a lot of internet privacy and security things, but they just within the past few days announced that after considering the issue for several months, they would not be forcing adult websites to institute age verification policies for that very reason. And they said instead they would be focusing on working with those sites to help develop filtering technology for parents, which kind of brings it back around to that issue in the first place. You know, I don't think that teens should be looking at porn more than likely either, but it's not my job to enforce that. And I don't think it should necessarily be the government's job to enforce that primarily and with my tax dollars.
To me, this is such an example of why libertarians have to be absolutely ferocious at the very, very beginning of debates like this. Because, you know, we all agreed that we were going to do this kind of half measure where, okay, you know, before you go to the, you know, booze websites and porn websites and a few other things, you have to do this kabuki of clicking I am over 18. Right. And like, if I recall correctly, that was actually at issue in the John Stagliano obscenity case. John Stagliano is a reasoned trustee. We covered his case. One of the central issues was that they had like a preview for some kind of adult entertainment that wasn't behind the click I am 18. And that that was the basis for the obscenity charges. We shouldn't have agreed to that from the beginning, because that, you know, that established the beachhead. That established the, like, we already know what you are, madam. We're just negotiating the price. Like, once we agreed that, like, sort of in theory, it was okay to do an age gate, an age wall, then people like this David French op-ed can just say, well, now we're just increasing the mechanism for enforcement. We already agreed this is okay. We do this all the time in the world. We are always inconveniencing adults to protect children. So why is it different? We should never have been doing that in the first place. We should have fought back at the beginning. And we did, but we lost.
I now want there to be a limited edition podcast. We can just suggest things here editorially on the Reason Roundtable podcast with Catherine called on. It's an interview, a sort of debate podcast, but more of a hectoring one called Why Your Op-Ed Is Wrong with Catherine Mangue Ward. And just get
great
David
way
French.
To make enemies, but also would be fun.
Would be pretty awesome. Did I hear some noise out there from one of the males?
Yeah. The other thing I would just say is that I mentioned that part of this was also be making the process of looking online porn extremely annoying for adults. And I think that is unstated in a lot of these arguments, but that is a positive for the people pushing these laws. Like,
yeah,
we want to stop children from looking at this. And if it also creates massive privacy concerns that make adults not want to look at porn, that is a bonus. They see that as a bonus. Their unstated goal is really to just stop adults from being able to look at this as well. And they know they can't really get away with it. So if this law makes it extremely annoying or even like, you know, privacy concerns make it completely unlikely that you'll actually look at porn, that is perfect in their view. So I think there is this sort of, you know, they're advancing the ball and then saying, okay, we're going to make this as hard for you as possible, but we're not going to say that's our real goal. So I think there is also, there's a little bit of, you know, hide the, a little bit
careful.
Of three-card Monty.
Hide the what?
Yes. Thank you, Catherine, for policing that. I will.
This is one of these things. When you try to write headlines for articles that have anything to do with sex or pornography, it immediately becomes clear that every single thing is an innuendo and you can't live. You can't go on. It's a real problem.
I recently was delighted by watching an old Dean Martin television episode with nothing but innuendo as they were doing a version of Tie Me Kangaroo Down Spot. Or sport, wow. Whatever it's called.
This is actually a great segue for me to promote CJ's cover story. Can I do it?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. CJ's cover story in the current issue is so good. It is about just a really, really horrific story that CJ has done some great reporting on. He can tell us about that story, but I want to tell you about the headline, which the cover of the magazine says, "I knew they were scumbags." This is a quote from someone about the law enforcement officers who ultimately confess to rape but are protected from any consequences to those actions because of the context in which they confessed. I learned after that issue came out with the origin of the term scumbag. Do you know the origin of the term scumbag, friends?
I know, it's a condom, right?
It's a used condom. A condom that has been used for its intended purpose. I didn't know that.
Oh.
When I put that word on our cover, I stand by it because it's a shocking story and a shocking cover is appropriate. And also, frankly, like the double meaning is appropriate for this story. They were scumbags. But there's your the more you know, like the star with the rainbow comes across the screen.
That is
that's moment for today.
A generational divide, Catherine, between us 55s and you early 40-somethings.
Yeah.
We all know.
CJ's story is excellent. I recommend that you check it out. It is infuriating. It is, as yet, an unresolved case. And CJ, I don't know if there's any more you want to add about anything that's happened since we wrapped that story or stuff people should know, but read it and be mad.
Oh, that's a pretty good rundown. Yeah, it was following the case of a large lawsuit in a federal prison in Florida where about a dozen women accused a group of guards of sexually assaulting and raping them over the course of several years. And this big lawsuit eventually wound its way through court, and a bunch of the women ended up getting fairly small settlements. But the main thrust of the story is I interviewed a father whose daughter was one of these women. She had been serving a couple of years for like a drug conspiracy or something like that. A few months after she finally got out of prison, she ended up dying of a drug overdose. And the story is sort of about his efforts to get justice for his daughter, because none of these guards were ever prosecuted. They were allowed to, most of them were allowed to retire after they had admitted in sworn interviews that they had raped women who were under their control. And so he has been trying for the past few years to get some prosecutor or someone to actually do something about this. You can read in the story about why it is so hard to prosecute those guards. There are some Supreme Court protections regarding what happened with their testimony that make it hard to prosecute them. And also, it's just a story of just levels and levels of bureaucratic failure, from the Bureau of Prisons to federal prosecutors to the judge overseeing their lawsuit. It was not an easy story to report, but it illustrates a lot of what's going on in our prison systems and why they are so rotten and hard to fix.
I just wanted to add one last thing on the Henry from the UK question, just because we didn't talk about the feminism aspect of it very much in the answers, just to say that I recall very strongly in the mid to late 80s, whatever wave of feminism that was very, there was a wing of it that was a wing of the wave, Catherine, was very strongly anti porn and censorious. A lot of it was centered around the movie Blue Velvet by David Lynch and its treatments of Isabella Rossellini and sexualized violence and whatnot. So that's been around with us for a long time. And it also informs, I do believe, that sort of sense of revulsion against, the creepier edges of what we assume are the creepier edges of pornography and sex work. It informs some of the reason why a lot of people are kind of asleep at the wheel when it comes to the prosecution of Backpage, which we've written about a lot. Mike Lacy, former Phoenix New Times chain head. As soon as you say the words child sex trafficking, people's critical faculties are just switched off. And they are not interested in a defense of it. It kind of reroutes their brains. There's been definitely for a long time a part of feminism that trends in that direction. But like Catherine said, I wouldn't attribute anything chiefly to that. Just as a societal issue, to use a word that Jesse Walker really loves. All right, let's get to a quick lightning round. Not that we have a ton of time for it. Last week, Hurricane Idalia, who knows, hammered Florida's Gulf Coast. CJ allegedly lives in Florida, I think on a brig of some kind, a floating brig.
Seasteading platform.
We talked on the roundtable a couple weeks back about various annoying libertarian insights that pertain to natural disasters. CJ, what kind of personal testimony can you quickly provide about how it's all either the government's fault or your fault for living there? And also bonus points for working in any Jimmy Buffett reference.
Well, first of all, we're in a state of mourning here in the Florida Keys for Jimmy Buffett, the pirate laureate of the Florida Keys.
Wow.
So that's the real, the hurricane pretty much completely missed the Keys. There were some like, there was some storm watch in the lower Keys, like Key West. That was it. We got like wind and rain. I had some branches down in my yard and that was it. So we came out of it unscathed except for the loss of our beloved Jimmy. So yeah, not a lot to report here. I was on the insurance front. It, you know, it's not the government's fault in my case because, well, the, for my mortgage, I have to have wind insurance, even though my house is a concrete block and it's not blowing away. So that's stupid. So I would just like to complain about that. You know, so that was dumb. But yeah, there's not a lot I have to report. The insurance industry in Florida is completely broken, which Joe might be able to talk a little more about. So I just like to generally complain about everything involving the insurance market in Florida.
Joe, you wrote about the flood insurance a bit. Talk very briefly about that.
Yeah. So federal law requires mortgage properties in flood-prone areas to carry flood insurance. The problem with that is, of course, if you're an insurance company, you are not going to be particularly incentivized to offer flood insurance in an area that frequently floods. So there's a federal program called the National Flood Insurance Program that provides federal backing for flood insurance policies that the private sector would otherwise prefer not to cover if at all possible. And in some cases, it actually subsidizes these. About 22% of those policies are subsidized. They cost around less than half of what they would otherwise. So you have policies that the market is indicating probably shouldn't be offered in the first place, and instead the government not only backs them, but in some cases actually gives people a discount. And there is these policies have no lifetime limit on the number of claims that can be made on the same property, no lifetime limit on the amount of money that can be recouped and in the life of the policy. And there are even a handful, a relative handful of properties that are referred to as repetitive loss properties that have been that have flooded and been rebuilt.
I know a couple dudes like that, honestly.
A couple employees like that, Catherine?
That's not what I said. Matthew Lee Welsh.
Present company. Never mind. But yeah, Pew, just a handful of years ago, compiled data showing that only about 1% of the national flood insurance policy program policies were repetitive loss properties. Only about 1% qualified as that, but they accounted for between 25 and 30% of the expenses of the program. So a relative handful of these properties are just constantly flooding. They're making claims, getting rebuilt, and the cycle repeats itself.
Catherine, do you have any other annoying libertarian thing to add to Hurricane Idalia?
I was reading some very fascinating thoughts from a website called Property Casualty 360, because that's the kind of thing you find sometimes when you do a Google News search.
I thought you're not supposed to look at porn, Catherine.
And yeah, I did have to upload my driver's license, actually, to be allowed to see this website. Just thought that people might be interested in this little factoid, which is that in the most flood-prone counties in the country, there has been a net influx of about 400,000 people in the last 2 years, according to Redfin. So this problem's going to get worse.
It's all New York going to Florida. I will add that the new thing that I hate about natural disasters, besides their murderous intent towards Jimmy Buffett, is the media attempt to start a politician fight. If there's like a key Republican and a key Democrat involved. So this was like, are you going to meet with Joe Biden, Ron DeSantis? What do you have to say about that, Joe Biden? Just like, stop it. Just stop it. And then the other is their attempt to ask gotcha questions of Republican governors in that circumstance. Like, this is about global warming, isn't it? It's like of all the relevant questions as of places sort of rebuilding, doesn't strike me as the number one. And this happens every single time one of these things. Knock it off. You people are bad. Okay. Let's go to our end of podcast. what you have been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
I have been consuming Reason's new crossword, which I don't think we've talked about enough on this podcast yet. I think the kind of people who listen to this podcast, I'm just stereotyping here, seem to me like the kind of people that might want to do a crossword every Friday at Reason.com. We have a very cool lady whose name is, hold on, I'm going to pronounce it correctly, Stella Zawistowski. Stella Zawistowski is her name, probably. And she's awesome. She hit us up at the live Reason Roundtable in New York City and said, hey, crosswords are kind of woke and we should do a libertarian one at Reason. And now we have one. So come to our crosswords. I am not a big crossword person, but I have like brought myself to the table here to test our products. But other Reason staffers have also, and we post our scores and times in the channel in an attempt to outdo each other. So be a part of that. Do it on Twitter if you want so that other people can also learn about Reason's super awesome crossword. You can see them at reason.com/puzzles. The most recent one is about immigrants. The one before is called Yes in My Backyard. And the one before that is called Let's Sue Bad Cops. So those give you just like some of the crossword vibes. Reason's Crossword by Stella Zawistowski. You know you want it.
I'm so glad I don't belong to that Slack channel. That sounds great. CJ, what have you been consuming?
I've also been doing the crossword, which is very good. I also endorse it. I like crosswords, and it's a quick, fun puzzle with some good libertarian clues that you'll appreciate if you're a Reason reader. The other thing I read was I read a new book that came out this summer called Whale Fall by Daniel Krauss, which is a book about a scuba diver who gets swallowed alive by a sperm whale and has to escape from the whale. I picked up this book because I got a pretty glowing New York Times review, and it also hits a bunch of my different interests, which is like ocean stuff and scuba diving. The book's about a it's like 17 or 18 year old teenager who goes scuba diving to recover the bones of his dead father from the ocean floor. His father was a drunk asshole who was also chronically underemployed or unemployed, but also a local legend in the diving community. And he committed suicide by filling his pockets with rocks and jumping into the ocean one day. So his son goes to go get his bones and in quite a predicament ends up getting caught between a battle between a sperm whale and a giant squid and ends up getting eaten in the process. And then has to both escape from the whale and come to closure with his dad and how much he hates his dad. So it's a very good, it's a fun beach read. All the chapters are like 2 or 3 pages long tops. So it's constantly switching between his memories of his deadbeat dad and his attempts to escape from the stomach of a whale. So if you're interested in ocean stuff and scuba diving, or have a morbid fascination with being eaten alive, or have closure issues with your father, you might find this interesting. I didn't like it as much as the New York Times. It's a little silly. The premise itself, it calls itself scientifically accurate. It's scientifically accurate once you get past the very improbable premise of surviving being swallowed by an 80-foot sperm whale.
Yes.
But quite fun. Would recommend.
Joe, what have you been consuming?
First of all, I'm going to be a little bit annoying and also recommend the crossword.
Yes.
I find crosswords vaguely soothing, and I really look forward to ours. I was a little bit skeptical at first of the concept of a Reason crossword, and I have rarely in my life been more wrong. It is a genuine pleasure. Past that, I am... this coming week is going to be the second season finale of The After Party on Apple TV Plus, and I've been enjoying that. It's a murder mystery comedy where both of the seasons so far have revolved around a murder, and the central detective character played by Tiffany Haddish sequesters all of the witnesses, interviews each one, and each episode focuses on a different witness recounting their version of events, which in their various tellings sometimes differ in facts, but typically differ in style. One character fancies himself a bit of a hard-nosed detective, and so his whole episode is black and white, 30s noir. One character is a twee little oddball, and so her entire episode is directed in the style of like a Wes Anderson movie. It is very fun and funny and enjoyable, and the finale of the second season is coming in just a couple of days, and I'm greatly looking forward to it.
I will not give testimony about the recent crossword puzzle. I'm holding out for the recent Immaculate Grid. Those of you who know. But I'm happy that it does exist. I'm going to recommend, even though I've only watched two of the available four episodes, I think it's four, of the second season, but it's so enjoyable. I need lots of ID, online IDs to watch the thing. HBO's second season of Winning Time, which is the, fictionalized or dramatized, accounts of the 1980s Los Angeles Lakers. And before Catherine totally turns off her...
Too late.
It's so much about management, Catherine. It is like all great art. It is about management.
Matt, I can't watch this document about management because I have finally given in and started watching Star Trek. So I am...
What?
I am consuming Star Trek exclusively through the lens... of management.
Of management.
Yes.
Also that.
I feel like this, we have to set this aside for another day, but I will say for a variety of reasons, I've decided to start with Next Generation and that people can fight me if they want.
That's so predictable. But
and
yes,
you can't see this in the booth, but as soon as you mentioned basketball, she picked up a newspaper and actually started doing a crossword.
It's rude a little bit, but that's okay. I'll take it. Anyways, Winning Time, it is so enjoyable. And it is, again, and I'm sure I said something very similar when I recommended the first season on HBO. It shows the advantages of doing a dramatization as opposed to doing a documentary. I've been watching too many documentaries about music of late and always, and they always just pull punches and they gloss over the whole like, oh, he was on heroin and crashed his car stuff that you should really be wallowing in a lot more. Winning Time on HBO just does it, you know, precisely because none of the players or managers have veto power over it, and some of them hate it with the fire of a thousand suns. Then it gets just to be gloriously like nasty, but also sweet. And I was a Laker fan growing up, and I remember all this stuff happening in real time. Some details that I didn't know. Some of the characterizations have been described as unfair, and I don't care. Jerry West, who is the legendary player turned executive, is just an alcoholic rage bear, and he of course hates this characterization, and people say it's unfair. It is so good. It is my favorite character in modern American television, is the Jerry West character on Winning Time. Why, Catherine? For managerial reasons. It's a lot of high-stress people trying to figure out, and each having their own actual, like, justifiable rationalization for disagreeing with one another about making high-level decisions in a stressful environment. So great. Just fun. Pure pleasure. Watch it if you like stuff like that.
Since Peter Suderman is not here and definitely won't listen to the end of this podcast because he doesn't really listen to podcasts, I just want to seed in listeners' minds that so far the main management lessons that I'm taking from Star Trek are that Peter Suderman is Riker.
Oh, he's going to hate that so much.
I know. That's why I'm saying it here. Don't tell him.
I don't know what any of that means. All right. That's enough Star Trek references for one episode of this podcast. I predict we'll have more in the future. Mm-hmm. But thank you for listening. Go to all our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts, including the this week concluding episode of our fantastic Eric Baim hosted podcast, You Can't Have Nice Things. This is the promo copy for that final episode. You already know the prices at the grocery store have gotten a lot more expensive in recent years, but we probably don't know is that federal policymakers right now are considering new tariffs on tin cans that could increase the price of soup, beans, and other items by as much as 30 to 50 cents each. On this week's sixth and final episode of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, host Eric Baim digs into that proposal. The craziest part of the whole thing is that the Commerce Department officials are not allowed by law to consider how those tariffs might affect consumers by, you know, raising prices at the grocery store. The first 5 episodes of Why We Can't Have Nice Things are also available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Reason.com, all those places. And Eric wants me to give you all a special thank you to those who have checked out the new series. And he beseeches you to leave a review after you listen to the last episode later on this week. I think that's about it. If you like what we do as an organization, please consider providing a tax-deductible donation at reason.com/donate for the rest. And maybe next week we will hear about what horrible things Nick Gillespie did at Burning Man. All right. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.